Hello and welcome to 20 Tim Minutes, a podcast that focuses on mental health in a serious but yet humorous way. Listen as I interview a wide variety of guests where we show our support as well as sharing our own personal struggles and stories with mental health. I am your host, Tim McCarthy, and now it's time to talk about it. Hey, what's going on, everybody? You're tuning into another episode of 20 Tim Minutes. I am your host, Tim McCarthy. Today, I am joined by professional wrestler, best known as Jimmy Jacobs. He has wrestled since the late 90s, most recognized for his time in Ring of Honor Wrestling. He's also the former writer of the WWE and is now working with Impact Wrestling. Jimmy, how the hell are you?
Hey, Tim. Thanks for having me here. I'm doing tremendous. Thank you.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing perfect now. We just had our rock, paper, scissors matchup, and you swept me in two moves. So I'm doing all right because of that, too. So if you're a fan of professional wrestling or not, if you listen to this, I feel like the life of a pro wrestler is very fascinating, with all the highs and lows as is in life. And I know you've been through your highs and lows yourself. Let's go through your career just super quick. We'll go right over it. Like, what made you get into pro wrestling and what did you love about it that kept you motivated?
I got into wrestling. My older brother liked wrestling. He's 3 years older than me. And just as his younger brother, I liked what he liked. And so I was a fan growing up, and he wanted to be a wrestler, so I wanted to be a wrestler. And in 1998, he found a local school to train at, and I just sort of followed him around until I had the opportunity to train a year later. And that was it. You know, I think when I look back, what I loved was the colorful characters. I liked Randy Savage. I liked the Ultimate Warrior. I liked Bret Hart, even though wasn't much of a colorful character as much as he just had colorful tights. And then when I was a little bit older, Mick Foley was like, my God, that was my hero. So I was a very shy boy. But when I started wrestling, when I went through that curtain, I was just unleashed. And in that, I loved and still do love performing. I love the release that when you walk out the curtain, the whole world just fades away. And it's just you in that moment. It's an example of really of mindfulness. It's an example of doing a project, a craft that keeps you in the moment. You're not in your head. You're not thinking about anything else. You're just there. You're there with the audience, with the guy you're performing with, and you're just in that center space, balancing between order and chaos.
Now, how did you block out everything else in your life? You was just so super focused on that. Like, if you had a problem in your personal life, you just went to wrestling and everything went away?
Yeah, I mean, look, I was not emotionally well-balanced for the first 34 years of my life.
Hear that?
Yeah, so certainly I was an emotional guy, but when I performed, I mean, I remember going through a breakup in, just in 2012 and in the Ring of Honor locker room in Baltimore, like crying on the locker room floor. And then you got to get up and you got to go. And in those moments, everything is gone. There is no breakup. There is no heartache. There's only performing in that moment.
And there was like a blurred line too, between like your personal life and your wrestling life from the outside looking in as like a fan per se. Like, so like, say you were in a bad mood and you came out, people don't know if that's like your personal life or what. And they might have like a little bit of a glimpse by it and they could like use that against you almost. And you're like, hey, like this is just entertainment.
Yeah. Well, certainly as performers, it's advantageous to harness that which is authentic inside of us. So certainly that was at play throughout the career of the stories of Jimmy Jacobs, is to blur that line and bring the reality of what's inside and manifest that in an artistic way.
Your character is very great. I would say legendary. I feel like you're a wrestler's wrestler. Like, I feel like, you think of, the WWF, growing up. It's like, you got all these big names. But, I feel like really diehard good fans know Jimmy Jacobs. Like, you've been wrestling for quite some time. You've been doing a lot of big things. Like, your biggest years were in Ring of Honor with wrestlers that are wrestling today. Like Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, you worked with them. I think a guy, Sami Zayn, maybe. I know there was a guy named El Generico that was kind of similar to him. I don't know if they're the same person. But when you were there, what was that like mentally when you're getting pretty much on the top? Because you were one of the main guys at Ring of Honor. Did you feel like you deserved it? Like, were you there mentally? Did you want more? Like, what was in Jimmy's head at that point in your career? Like, was that mid-2000s?
2007, 2008 is when I was working on top, really, at Ring of Honor. And look, it's something that I had worked for my whole career. For whatever that was, 8-9 years at that point, part of me, when I look back at it, I can appreciate the creative freedom because we had so much creative freedom. It was, a large enough platform that we had, we had good fans, but we didn't have any real masters to answer to, which, and of course now with, if you're working on TV or wherever, it's like, you've got a lot of things to answer to. So we had so much creative freedom there. So I can appreciate that. And I can appreciate a lot of it, but I was miserable. One of the things in life is when all you do is want more, all you're going to do is want more. And that's it. So the thing that drives you forward is also the thing that makes you a prisoner unto yourself. So, and I've seen this with a lot of people, a lot of very successful people. And you can get this thing, but you just want the next thing. And once you have the next thing, you want the next thing. And without a proper foundation internally, that'll just lead you on a wild goose chase your entire life. You will be a dog chasing a tail your entire life. And I remember in 2008 working on top and being miserable.
Yeah, that's got to be a tough feeling going through that. And how old were you at the time?
I was 23, 24.
Yeah, I feel like those are the types of ages we go through and we're like trying to still figure things out and we know everything and we don't. And then at our age now, we go back in time and be like, dude, you don't know shit. All right.
Yeah. Well, I think, what's funny is I think you can look back at any time in your life and realize you go, oh, I thought I knew what was going on back then, but I was so stupid. And what you come to realize is that's any time in your life. Right now, at this moment, you think you know what's going on, but you have no clue. And in 5 years, if you're lucky, you will look back at this moment and you will realize how stupid you are now. So we just really go through our entire life, hopefully being a little less stupid than we were before.
Exactly. I can get behind that perfectly. Now, at that time, how was it with the drug use around that? Were you a person that got into it because of wrestling? Did you have any issues with drugs at all at that time? What was that like?
Yeah, man. 2007 was the first time I thought, oh, these drugs are a problem. I started doing drugs in late 04, early 05. I didn't start drinking until I was 21. I didn't drink in high school. And, I liked pills. They made me feel good. So that was the beginning. Those were the early years when it was still fun. When you're talking about, 05, 06, 07, it was still mostly fun. It got a little unfun in 07. But it was after that, that it became less fun.
Now, why did you start? Was it because it was just recreational? Everyone else was doing them? Were they hey, man, this will help out your neck, your back? How did that transcend?
I mean, not everybody else was doing them. At that point, there weren't a ton of drugs in wrestling, but they were there.
Yeah.
Look, it started almost as a gag. we would They're like, oh, let's be like those old school wrestlers, you know, take some pills, brother. You know, it was like a joke. It was a parody of itself. And So I would do it once in a while. But the first time I took 2 Vicodin, that was it. And it was like a weight was lifted off my chest that had been there my entire life. And I could finally breathe. And that was the feeling that I wanted to have more and more and more and more. And I spent the next, you know, more or less 12 years chasing that feeling.
You might not know this either, and I always wonder this with people, especially when they're getting drugs like that are prescribed by doctors and stuff. It's like, who is getting it at that extent? Like when I go to the doctor's office, they're barely giving me Tylenol, like extra strength. It's like, I never knew how it got to that point where someone could get those types of drugs that had like a lot of street value. Is it just because of the money aspect? Like how are those pills getting distributed so easily?
I mean, I was buying them from people. The only time I think a doctor prescribed anything to me was maybe I cracked a rib once and after knee surgery. But man, back in those days, it was still the Wild West with pills.
Yeah.
It's different now. But I had three different friends that had a prescription for 360 30 milligram oxycodone a month. 360 30 milligram oxycodone a month. It was madness. It was absolute madness.
You could take out a village with that.
Yeah, well. Or if your tolerance builds up, you go through that in a week, you know, and that's what it was.
That is amazing. What type of injuries did you go through?
I mean, look, the ACL, I tore my ACL in 06, had surgery in 07. I fractured my neck in, it was 2010, 2011. And, you know, just other small things, but those are both my ACLs are torn now, and so it goes, it's fine. But yeah.
How was that mentally on you though? Because you're an entertainer and you can't go out and entertain. Like obviously sometimes they can throw you out there on crutches and get some things done, but like, what are you doing while that's going on? Especially if you're making money in a company, like how are you mentally stable in that? I mean, you have like nothing really else going on, or what are you doing to fill that void?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mostly worked through it. You know, I still wrestle now and both my ACLs are torn and it's fine. It's not a big deal. So I tore my ACL, my left knee in 06, had surgery in 07. And look, I was a broke, poor pro wrestler. I was spending my money on drugs a lot, and also I wasn't making a lot of money. But even after I had surgery, Ring of Honor still booked me to be around. A lot of the companies I had great relationships for booked me to still be around, but it was hard to make ends meet. I started substitute teaching a little bit in that time in like 2007, just to try to be a little less poor, or, you know, weekends that weren't so good.
Right.
But yeah, I mostly worked through the injuries. The injuries didn't matter. I didn't take very good care of myself for like most of my life.
You still look good, my man. You still look good.
Thank you.
You're around my age and you still have your hair. I don't, so.
I take care of myself now.
Perfect, perfect. Were you still in character when you were substitute teaching or what?
No, I mean, gosh, it was bad, man. I cut a promo a time or two. Finally stopped substitute teaching at all. I did a little bit through like 2010 to my work started to slow down a little bit. And at some point at one of the schools I was at, somebody Googled my name and then Jimmy Jacobs came up. And then like by the end of the day, it was like this big controversy that the substitute teacher was this like weird pro wrestler. Like I remember in the last period of the day, like looking over and somebody's phone was out and it's like the picture of me like drenched in blood after I bathed in Jay Briscoe's blood. And I was like, oh, I'm never, this is it. This is my last day ever as a substitute teacher, which I was fine with. It was, Yeah, it was funny. It was a funny time.
I think it's very funny when people that don't follow or watch pro wrestling and they see like the outside looking in, especially for someone like you to see like all your collections and what you've been through. To Google your name as like as a wrestler is going to be pretty funny.
Yeah, and you know how rumors are. You know, it went from this pro wrestler to, you know, I had some videos online talking about addiction. And so it's like, oh, he's a drug addict too.
Yeah.
And then the rumor started that I was like also in porn as well. And, you know, kids thinking I'm a porn star or whatever it was. It was really wild. You know, my Twitter feed like blew up with all these kids talking about me. And I remember I was probably 27 or 26 at the time and reading all the stuff online and going, I am so glad I am not a high school kid because I would never want to go back to school. And I was an adult and I didn't want to go back and I never did. That was it. I was done. I was like, oh, well, that's the end of that, which I was fine with. I was doing all right otherwise, so.
I think about that all the time. Like you were getting bullied as a substitute teacher. Like imagine the bullying that would have happened like that. I always say that. I'm like, if we had phones and like Snapchat when I was like in high school, I'd be like, it would be terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. The digital world seems to, in a lot of ways, certainly a lot of pockets of it, bring out, the worst in people, you know, and Twitter, particularly seems to, really promote, combative
negativity.
Interactions. So
did you disable your Twitter account?
I did. Yeah. I've been on and off of social media, a bit. I just reactivated my Instagram.
Yeah. I saw that.
About a month ago or so, but yeah, I was off Twitter I was off all social media for about 7 months last year. And then again, this year, I'm like, what am I doing here? This is a cesspool. And I don't mean that to be negative. It seems as though it attracts people who want to combat. And look, we all have the urge to, let's say, be right and then argue with somebody in these really small amounts of characters. And what's seeming to happen is there's this like negative feedback loop of people sort of criticizing others, and then they get rewarded for criticizing others, and then that brings people to a fight. And there's some reasonable people, I think like myself, that have stepped back from it and gone, yeah, no thanks. And as more reasonable people step back and say no thanks, all that's happening is it's the feedback loop of negativity is just going increasing more and more and more. So it's really bringing out the shadow in people and bringing out a lot of unresolved trauma and just like this amplification that's coming forward. And I don't mean to give social media as such that sort of power, because this comes from the individual, but yeah, it is a tool that has illuminated this this shadow in many people.
I always said that if you have to use the internet or like social media, you have to like submit your license. Because so many people hide behind a computer, phone, whatever it is, and they talk the most shit. And I'm like, if you gave like who you were, you wouldn't be doing this. So I think people need more human interactions than social media interactions.
Absolutely. We're coming at a point in time where it seems as though, look, I'm not going to say the digital world is in and of itself bad, because it's great in a lot of ways, but it seems as though the human brain was not meant to have this sort of stimulation that these cell phones and computers are providing for us. So people are becoming slaves to this, you know, the intermittent reward system of the dopamine fixes of all these apps on their phone. As well as the truth is, and the longer I go on, I really start to believe this, anything outside of your immediate experience more or less is a distraction, that your homework is what's in front of you. And that doesn't mean that, you know, again, the digital world is wrong and great, you and I are connecting on it and we can connect with more people. But the truth is, your homework is what's in front of you. So as, like, we weren't meant to care about everybody else in the world. That's the truth. We weren't meant to care about everything that's going on everywhere, because you don't have the energy to care for that. And so now your attention is way over here, way over here, way over here, way over here, and you can't get done what's being called to for you to do that's right in front of you. Your own house is in a mess. Your own relationships are in a mess. You are disconnected from, you don't know your neighbors. You're disconnected from your community. You don't know anything that's going on the block you live on. Yet you are worried about what a character on television, what, you know, what a politician who is really a character on a TV show, as far as you know, that's all you know that person as. The President of the United States is a character on TV to you. That's it. And yet you spend time arguing with strangers about the pros and cons of a character on your TV. You go, what is this? This is a distraction. And so as beneficial as it seems as though the internet is, in many ways, we are more disconnected than ever. And as one pulls back from this picture, you go, well, what's happening here? Well, you've exchanged the organic world for the inorganic one. And as such, your connection to your actual life has diminished, and the distractions and the time wasting and the confrontations have raised.
I absolutely love that. I'm smiling for two reasons, because that was like perfectly said, and like the whole analogy of it all, I absolutely love. And the second part of my brain was thinking about that was you during a substitute teaching course saying that exact same thing to kids being on their phones. And that would be hysterical in my head if you just like yelling at these kids. But no, I agree with like 110% of everything you just said. You put it perfectly. Like, this conversation was worth it just on that alone. So I do appreciate that, your two cents on that. That was perfect.
Yeah, and look, you don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth. You and I are communicating on this right now. It's not to say there aren't good things.
Yeah.
But it's to say that a balance must be made, lest we fall into this trap. And a lot of us are. And I'm aware of it, and I fall into the trap. I'm aware of it, and I spend, you know, too much time on the damn thing. It's a difficult task in something like self-discipline.
And really, I'm the same way. I love how the noise just went off when you picked that up too. It's like, it just goes to show. Like, I feel like all of our necks are just going to be like this, like over time, like just like the way our spines are moving, just looking down. It's like not even like healthy on your eyes, your body, your mind. It's just, but we use it because it's like a visual drug.
Yes, it is. And the developers of these apps know that, and it's, again, it's not to blame them. We're the ones that are making demand for it. So don't blame the supplier, because if there was no demand, it wouldn't be like this.
Yeah.
So we have drug dealers. It's like, yeah, we do have drug dealers. They are dealing us this drug, but we are the ones that are going, yeah, just give me more of that. Just give me more. Just give me more.
Very true. That is very true. I love our little tangents on social media, because I go on the same ones. I go down these like TikTok rabbit holes of like how much I hate TikTok. So I feel like we could do like 3 hours on that. It'd be funny. Stop shaking your hair in front of me. All right. I know. I get it. So back up just a little bit, back to like the Ring of Honor days and injuries and just dealing with things. I always forget about this one, and you're going to have to paint a picture with people that probably that don't know, is you had a spot, which is like a move that's about to happen in wrestling with fellow wrestler BJ Whitmer, where you pretty much just got dropped on like every, I don't even know what part of your body you almost dropped on, but like how close of your career was actually ending in that moment?
Yeah. So it was in Detroit in March of 2006. I'm sure if you go on YouTube and look up Jimmy Jacobs, BJ Whitmer powerbomb, it's probably on there. And we were both standing on the top rope, and we used to do a spot where he picks me up for a powerbomb while we're both standing on the top rope, and I give him a hurricanrana into the ring. It's old like Kid Cash Easy Money spot. And he slipped. He slipped backwards outside of the ring. And I didn't realize he slipped because I'm like, you know, I'm down and I'm up and I'm down. So I don't know we're going backwards. So if you look on the video closely, I'm still trying to like rotate back to give him a hurricanrana. And if he hadn't had the presence of mind to throw me forwards, I would have been upside down when I hit the ground. Like it was really, the first time I saw it on video, I was like, whoa. That was really close. Unfortunately, he had the presence of mind to throw me forwards. My head hit the top rope, middle rope, bottom rope, and apron, and I was fine. He broke his ankle. I was fine.
What friends will do for you?
Yeah.
Like, so you were totally fine with that? I thought no injuries whatsoever.
Absolutely fine. As far as I knew, we were on the top rope, we were up, and then we were down on the ground, and I asked him if he was okay. I remember thinking that I kind of wanted to end the match there just because I thought that would be a good finish. It seemed like it was like this holy shit moment. But at that point in my career, I didn't have the sort of weight or the pull to make that call in that moment. It was like, we still have more spots to do that Gabe needs me to do. And but I remember at that point being like, yo, that should just be it. And but I didn't know if we were going to do another match. So I was still, I didn't have the pull to make that call.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember why.
Yeah, that's I'll be posting that video as well. It's definitely scary on the line of like almost faces of death.
Yeah. It's one of the gnarliest bumps you'll see in wrestling.
Yeah,
it really is. Yeah,
sure. You've been through the ringer. You've been through a lot. Before we dive into the WWE thing, there's a couple things. Like, it's not that I don't forget because for any reason, but I was going over your resume again because you have an extensive resume. Like, you're no joke. You've been you're still relevant. Like, you've been relevant from like 2000s. So two things that I saw and I was like, I can't wait to bring these up. So before you got hired with the WWE, you worked for both Wrestling Society X, if people remember that, for MTV, the short-lived career, and you were with Juggalo Championship Wrestling. Can you just go over both of those two a little bit and how, like, what those were like? Because one was an MTV show and then one was run by the Insane Clown Posse. So I feel like those both have some good, interesting stories for each of them.
So Wrestling Society X was, we shot it in 2006. So I was 2006? Yeah. So I was 22 years old and it was great. My career was like starting to come up and I just did a tryout for TNA a couple months before that. And then, you know, a show on MTV, like to me, like the world was happening
in
2006 at 22. And you got to give it to, you know, Kevin Kleinrock and Big Vision Entertainment for getting wrestling on MTV.
Like, yeah.
What a feat. I remember early on, though, you know, like any other project in wrestling, I'd been in the business then since, you know, 99 and been around it since 98 on small levels. So I knew nothing happens until it happens.
Yeah.
You know, and even when it happens, it really hasn't even happened yet because it's like, well, what's going to come of it, right? So there was a lot of, you know, I think big talk about, you know, we're going to be on MTV and you guys are going to be at the Video Music Awards and all this sort of stuff. And I remember being cynical or maybe realistic at 22, just kind of going like, stop feeding me, you know, this stuff.
Yeah.
To me, nothing's happened. It doesn't matter until it happens. Again, when it happens, like the show. it got on MTV and awesome, but it's not like anything transpired about it, you know, with it. So, it's, you know, it's like, it's a fun thing to talk about with you, but, you know, beyond that, it's not that, you know, oh, MTV star Jimmy Jacobs. There was none of that. It was, it was an awesome experience. They treated us great. We shot it in LA. It was awesome. Everybody was great. It was wild. It was wild to have the explosions. It was wild to have, you know, Good Charlotte doing commentary on my match. You know, all this sort of stuff was a really awesome time.
And it was on like a weird time though, wasn't it? It was on like late at night.
It was Tuesday night at 10:30. So that was like the 10 spots on MTV. But MTV wasn't behind the show. It was like they agreed to it, and then all of a sudden, like, why did we agree to have pro wrestling? Like, so they didn't, we weren't promoted really at all. And then after like the third week on TV, there was a shakeup at MTV, and the one guy we had that liked our show didn't. We were off for a week, then on for a week, then off for a week, and then they just ran like a marathon of the last 4 or 5 episodes and didn't even show the last episode. It was a bit of a mess once it came down to it. So, but incredible experience. And as far as the ICP goes, you know, ICP is from, they're from Detroit.
Oh, yeah.
I'm from Michigan. And so, see, I forget the first time I worked for them, but I ended up doing stuff with them on and off throughout the years. And tons of respect for those guys for creating the empire that they created. They have these fans that aren't even fans. And I don't want to call it cults, but it's closer to something like that than, oh, I just like ICP. Nobody just likes ICP. I don't think there's a lot of like casual ICP fans. It's like you either don't like ICP or you've got a Hatchet Man tattoo on your neck. Like those are the two options.
And that's exactly so doing things like
you know, the Gathering of the Juggalos was wild stuff, and I was a heel there. I was the emo warrior Jimmy Jacobs, and I would read poetry before my matches. And for a few years, for most of the years, the fans would throw stuff like in the, like that's all they would do, just like pelt you with things. After my knee surgery in 07, my first match back was against Ultimo Dragon at the Gathering of the Juggalos.
No shit.
And by the time I get in the ring, you know, it's like crackers and soda and sticks. There was some sort of like pig meat, it looked like, that was in the ring. And so the whole match, I'm fresh back from knee surgery. I'm just trying not to get hit. You can probably see me like covering the back of my head a lot. I wrestled Ken Shamrock at the Gathering of the Juggalos in like 09, I think.
Shit.
And with Dan Severin as the referee, but Dan set a mask on and he unmasked after the match was over. And Ken and I we had about a 6 or 7 minute match called, and this is on YouTube. And we get in the ring, he gives me like one thing, I take a powder, and he's supposed to come and kind of chase me around the ring. And I'm waiting for him. And as I'm waiting for him on the outside, people are like just dumping stuff on me. And I hop up on the apron and I say, hey, Dan, tell him to come get me. And he goes, Ken wants to go home. I go, great. And I get in the ring and one, done. Like we did about 30 seconds of action because I don't think he wanted to get pelted with shit. And most wrestlers didn't. So, but ICP was amazing, man. Tons of respect for those guys.
They've been through it all. They did WWE, WCW, ECW. I think they did TNA for a little bit too. They've been around the ringer too.
Yeah, man. Yeah, legends.
So now let's speed up. Now you get hired with the WWE, which I feel like most people, is that's like the mecca of wrestling, they can say. I would say the majority. I'm curious with that is, how do you get that job? Like, are you on LinkedIn submitting your resume with like a cover letter? Like, how do you get your foot in the door at WWE? Like, because you got hired as a writer. I know you did you wrestled a little bit as WWE as like a quote unquote jobber. If people don't know what that is, it's like a enhancement talent for another wrestler to look great. And you actually wrestled Eddie Guerrero, which is probably, it's got to be on your top of the list of people you wrestled. Granted, you probably didn't put a move in, but that must have been great. But how was that like getting a job at the WWE, like getting in the door, and then we'll go from there.
Well, I think a normal human being, if they want to get a job as a writer in WWE, I think they've got a website. If you just look up like WWE corporate, they've okay. got they've got, you know, whatever job openings there. And so I went in an unconventional way. I was the first independent wrestler that they hired as a writer there. And basically, I had this epiphany moment of going, oh, I'm not supposed to be a wrestler. I'm supposed to work in creative. I get it. This is where the path leads. As soon as I had this epiphany moment, the rest was easy. I just put one foot in front of the other. But, you know, I called in favors. First, I called in favors to have come in as an extra. So as just, you know, extra talent, you know, they yeah. have a few local guys that come in. And so once I was booked as an extra, I called Joey Mercury and I called Daniel Bryan and I said, hey, this is what's happening. I'm going there as an extra. I want a job as a writer. Put me in front of the people to make that happen. And, you know, I built up over the many years, where people wanted to see me there, you know. My coworkers over the years understood the value I had. It might not be as a performer necessarily, but certainly as a creative type. So, so yeah, Daniel Bryan and Joey Mercury brought me in front of the guy that manages the creative team, and he said, "Give me a resume, and we'll get the ball moving of, you know, an interview and all this sort of stuff." And I did the interview. I did a sample writing, and it was great, man. It was a really fun time in my life.
Oh, I would imagine being a wrestling fan and a wrestler since 1998, 99, like you said. How was it dealing with people like Vince McMahon? Because all the stories you read about, it's like it's hard to work for him. And then, like, how many times is a script changed? Like, you're a writer, you present it, and then, like, nothing I hate more than when you come up with a great idea, you rush to it, and you bring it to somebody, and they're like, yeah, that's all right. And you're like, shit. Like, how does that go?
Well, you learn to get okay with that pretty quickly. You can't be married to any of your ideas because it changes so much. And it changes from this week to next week. It also changes in this day. And, you know, there'll be multiple drafts of the scripts. And whatever you plan to do the following week, you pretty much forget that, mostly. So you learn that your job isn't to come up with one idea that is going to change the world. Your job is to come up with a ton of ideas and one of them is going to be what Vince agrees on doing and that you do. That's it. So you learn to not be married to anything in particular.
Yeah.
How is it working with a person like Vince? I guess that assumes Vince a person. So
That makes sense. Now, so you say you have a script made and it's getting set for Raw or whatever. How many alterations or changes happen in that hour?
Well, the script will, like, a version will have been written over the weekend. And depending on when Vince first sees that version, by Sunday, changes might need to be made. And gotcha. then Monday at whatever, 11 o'clock or noon, there's the production meeting. And then coming out of the production meeting, things are going to change. And then Vince is going to go into his little office with the head writer, and they're going to look through things, you know, more meticulously, and it's going to change. And then it's like, who knows is the answer. And who knows how much it's going to change. Look, it's going to change on some level a handful of times, yep. right? There's going to be a handful of scripts. It's really a matter of if at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, you're going to get word that, you know, seg one is completely different now. Like that's, you know, that's the stuff that throws you off. Or something, and this happens all the time, that Vince agrees to going into Monday, and then during production meeting, one producer will be like, I don't know if we want to do this, Vince. Do we really want to have this match? It's like, oh, yeah, good point. And that's the entire thread of the show. The entire story of the show is built around this thing. And then you are rewriting the whole show, or the main chunk of the show, the main story of the show that that day, which is fine. Again, it's part of the job. But oftentimes, those changes are lateral moves. And there's no way you can have long-term storytelling then. You know, how do we write a long-term story if you can't come in Monday and know what you're doing and have it not? Once it changes Monday, go, well, the dominoes fall. The Rubik's Cube is moved. So the stuff that you plan for a month from now, it's like throw it out the window. So that's why in WWE there is basically no long-term storytelling, which is fine. It's Vince's show. He gets to do that, but not my show.
Yep. Makes sense. That all makes sense. I like having these questions answered. Now, you were most famously known for the List of Jericho storyline, which everyone knows. You've talked about it multiple times. But how did that feel inside for you to get to that journey of getting into the WWE, like pretty much being like, hey, I want to be a writer, and it happened, and then having one of the most successful storylines be produced? Like, how did you feel mentally and like emotionally? Like, were you just feel like on top of the world?
It was an awesome time. It was an awesome time working with Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens. Chris and Kevin, I forgot we used to do that. We used to do that bit where Chris would say his name first in the duo, and Kevin would say his name first. Team Chris and Kevin, Team Kevin and Chris. It was so much fun. It was a good time.
Yeah.
Once we found what the bits were, it was just a blast to write. And sure, there was, you know, I liked working for WWE. I didn't like working for Vince. You know, there's no resentment or bitterness towards Vince. It's just at that point in my life, I did not handle working for Vince well. So as fun as it was to work with Chris and Kevin, there's this black cloud of Vince that hangs over me during that time. But, you know, the List of Jericho was, it got the biggest reactions on the show.
Yeah.
You know, we did a whole episode where Rollins steals the list and Chris is looking for the list through the episode. It was absurd. It was awesome. You know, when Chris was a babyface a few months later, that's how they used to close the house shows. You know, you close the house show with Chris Jericho putting that city on the List of Jericho.
Yeah.
You know what happens, Pittsburgh? What happens when you've been an awesome crowd tonight? You know what happens? You just made the list, and you send them home with the biggest pop.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, man, great time.
It was one of the more better storylines like in the past. Like for like someone my age that like one of those like grumpy like, oh, the Attitude Era, blah blah blah. It was like such a good, refreshing storyline to go, because you always look for it, because both of those wrestlers are really good wrestlers to begin with, but them on the mic and them like being comedic like actors with that is like even like the cherry on top of it all. So yeah, that was like probably phenomenal from beginning to end. You don't see that often.
Yeah, it was a fun time, man. Fun time. So Chris, it's having great.
That's I love it. I absolutely love it. Now you were fired from WWE, correct? I always wanted to make sure of this. So you were fired because you took a photo with old friends from a different promotion that came and invaded like the WWE. So like, what was that like? So they saw the photo, like, hey, get in the office. And like, did they scold you? Like, what was that like?
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, it was, that's exactly what it was like. Yeah, I got a text from my buddy saying that the Young Bucks were outside the arena. And I was like, oh, awesome. And I went outside the arena and I saw them. I was happy to see them. And right at the end, I was like, yo, let's take a picture. And it was just going to be for me. And then I was standing in Gorilla, a standing gorilla position, and I just remember I had my phone. And I just like, you know what? Fuck it. And I put it on my Instagram. And you know, part of it is just I was for about the 6 months before that, I was pretty much ready to go.
Yeah.
And it was screw it. Let's see what happens. I felt like I was just so restricted there. It's a me thing. I'm not blaming anybody. Yeah. I felt like I couldn't be myself. I felt like backstage I was in a box. Look, people have called me eccentric. Fine. Maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. Vince certainly thought I was. And so he's like the Nakamura of the writing team. Yeah, man, I acted out and I knew I was going to get in trouble. Probably. I knew it probably make some people mad, but yeah. Whatever. Yeah. So about 15, 20 minutes later, I was in the writer's room. They kicked everybody else out of the office, out of the room. And, my boss, Dave and Road Dog and Michael Hayes, you know, were there. And Dave's like, you know, what the hell is this? Why am I seeing this? And I just kind of like, oh, you know, I really wasn't thinking. You want me to delete it? And like, no, if you delete it, it'll just make a bigger problem of it, as if it'll draw attention to the fact, you know? And look, Triple H was mad about it. Yeah. And so I went and I talked to Triple H, and he was cool. He was like, yo, what the hell were you thinking? I went, you know, I kind of wasn't. And, you know, and we had a discussion about it, and Triple H was fine. Is he the one that eventually, you know, threw me under the bus? Because eventually I had to get back to Vince. Yeah. I don't know who it was. It doesn't matter to me. So I don't know exactly how it was brought to Vince's attention. My guess is my boss just told him, was like, hey, Vince, this is what we dealt with, and, you know, just wanted to bring this to your attention. And Vince, that's just my guess. So if somebody could have, you know, I don't know who, but could have sort of threw me on the bus otherwise. But I remember that day being on the bus, and we took like a tour bus from town to town. I remember being in my bunk and just being so excited. Just this writing in my journal at the thought of, oh, I could get fired for this. And the relief in my body that felt that I might get fired, to go, wow, I could go do anything. And that's how much I was a prisoner to myself there. I was a prisoner to myself in that I just didn't have the courage to just go, hey guys, thank you, but I'm done here.
Yeah.
Because like you said, WWE was the mecca for me. So what's on the other side? What's on the other side of, you know, of the place you've worked your whole life to get. And so there was a lot of fear there. And it was such a blessing to get fired from the WWE. And it was this gift from the universe to go, hey, look, you know what's on the other side? Nothing to fear. It's all okay. You know, the best times of my life are I shouldn't say it's, life has been great in these last few years. Not that it wasn't great in WWE, but it was, there's nothing to fear on the other side of the abyss. It's fine. The abyss is fine, guys. Guess what? The abyss is okay. You go in there, it's a little scary. You come back out better than you were.
Yeah.
Hero's journey. Yeah.
Now you got fired and you were pretty open about this. You were addicted to opium.
Opiates. Yeah. Opiates. Like, you know, Vicodin, Percocet, you know, a little bit of heroin. Yeah.
Was it the same from when you started in ROH? Was it like, it was just a flatlining problem that you had and it got worse, or was it up and down? Did you get back into it? What was that like?
It was up and down. Yeah. In 2010, I got clean for a little bit. You know, I started in like 04, 05, 2010, there was like a 6-9 month span and it was great. I remember 2000, that was great. I mean, I did some videos for Dragon Gate USA talking about it. And that was all real.
Yeah.
You know? And it was, that was a great time. And then I tore the graft on my left knee that was surgically repaired. And so then just, and then it was just back into the thing, you know, it was back into the, all the mess. And, you know, Vicodin and Percocet, but then it was everything else too. So it's just like, wait, whatever you can get your hands on. And that was pretty much my life. And it's no fun spending your time and energy looking for drugs and being good when you're on drugs and not when you're not on them and going through withdrawals and then finding the pills. It's an awful trap of a rat race. I mean, it really is. The question, you know, I saw this thing, it was on the Tony Robbins documentary on Netflix, you know, I'm Not Your Guru. And he says something like, you know, the question you ask most often is the person you are, or something like that. And I go, well, what question do I ask the most? It's who's got pills? That's the question I ask the most. Who's got pills? So, man, that was my life. And in April of 2017, I was like, I can't do this anymore, man. Yeah. I was like, I was so desperate. And yeah, I went to rehab and it was great.
Would you consider yourself high functioning? Like when you were addicted, like you got like how?
Yeah, I mean, my whole, you know, latter half of my career, all my time in WWE, you're talking, you know, all this stuff. I was going through withdrawals the first time I worked with John Cena we're in Atlanta, you know, doing a promo with John Cena and, you know, one of my favorites. And I was like going through withdrawals at that time and, you know, in that whatever. I was high function, sure.
How would you like, if you were on the outside looking in, you went back in time to show somebody some signs that you were having an issue, would you have any telltale signs of that or no?
Probably me going, hey, do you know where I can get Vicodin? Yeah, I mean, that would probably be it. I don't think it was a secret from most people that I was just always looking for drugs.
Yeah.
I had some embarrassing nights drunk. I had some embarrassing times on somas, but who hasn't, right? Somas. But I was pretty high functioning.
I just always assume that, like, if you're so good at hiding it, would you be able to tell it? Besides, like, obviously being like, hey man, you got any pills? Like, I didn't know if there was like little telltale signs for people like that.
I wasn't hiding it for the most part. Yeah. I think most people I was around, I don't want to put any, they all knew and didn't help me.
Yeah.
I think I was pretty open about it. And like I said, I think people think I'm an eccentric guy sometimes. So it's part of the package, I guess. Maybe you go, oh yeah, he's a weird guy. You know, whether you know him on drugs or not, it's like, yeah, he's just weird. So
yeah. He's a weird guy. So with rehab that got fixed, did you have any, like, what was that like after you started getting better? Like, what was the come up like? Was there any hurdles in the way? Did you feel like you were going to go back down the hole?
No, and I never felt like I was going back down the hole. And to this day, it's even weird to think about. Like, I have no cravings for, you know, Vicodin or Percocet. Every once in a while, I was like, I wish I can do whatever I want, but part of me like goes, I wish I drank a little bit, you know. It's like I miss going on dates and having a drink or two, right? Yeah. But I also know where that goes, and I don't play with that. No, look, even when I went into rehab, I understood that it wasn't about drugs. It's not about drugs. It's not about it. The drugs are a manifestation of something. I don't put drug addiction, you know, in this, you know, pyramid of destructive, pyramid of addiction. I don't put drugs as like, oh, this is something and this is something else. It's like, no. It's the same thing. This and this are the same thing. It's just one you have to address because it's acutely dangerous and it's not a, you know, medium to long-term solution for anything. So you can't keep going with it. But we all, you know, I look at drug addiction as a behavior of looking for something outside of yourself to complete you, you know, and maybe that's too reductionist, but ultimately that's what it comes down to. And that's what a lot of our behaviors end up coming down to if we don't examine who we are and why we're doing what we're doing. If we interact with the world through a place of deficit, that is where I need to take, gain, achieve, grab in order to feel whole and complete. If we are operating in the world through that way, drug addiction is one of the manifestations of that, a particularly more pernicious one. Even when I went into rehab, I knew it wasn't about the drugs. For me, I thought it was about managing my emotions, and which is partly true. But when one realizes what it means to manage one's emotions, you know, very early on when I got out of rehab, I was just trying to figure out how to live without drugs. But very quickly, it became a journey of self-discovery. Because, you know, when I go, well, how do I manage my emotions? And then the question becomes, well, what are these emotions? And wait, I thought I'm just an emotional guy. Wait, no, I'm not just an emotional guy. That's a story I've been telling myself for my whole life because I'm bad at managing my emotions. That's actually a habit and a skill I can learn. So if I'm not this story I'm telling myself, am I also not this other story I'm telling myself about me and who I am? And then very quickly, the question became, wait a minute, who am I? Because right now it just looks like I'm a character that has these habits. And I like thinking of myself in certain ways that reinforces the habits and reinforces this character that I call Chris, right? That's my name, Chris. This character that I call Chris. And you go, so who am I? And then very shortly after that, the question became, no, it's not who am I? It's what am I? What is underneath the character that I've created for myself? What's underneath bad habits? What's underneath coping mechanisms? What's underneath all of this? And the past 4 years, it's just been peeling back the layers and going, yeah, I'm not this. I'm not this. This is just a, you know, false identification. Even now, I'm not in the sober world. Well, one, I use psychedelics. And two, it's just another false identity. It's just I saw after a year of being sober, I saw that it was just a thing that my ego liked to attach to. And look, it's better to attach to the identification of being sober than the identification of being a drug user and an act of addiction, right? But I saw even the label of sober as going, oh, I see the ego deriving enjoyment out of going, I'm this many days sober, I'm this many days sober. And I just saw it as a false identity. And at that point in my life, I was like, I'm shedding the identification with the ego here. And that's a lot of what this past few years of my life has been about, just connecting with the thing that is inside of me, the true me, the true you, the true all of us, the true self.
I see that on your YouTube. We talked about this earlier, the finding peace in the midst of chaos. That was a video I liked a lot. Could you talk about that a little bit real quick? Your insight of that?
Yeah. Last year, of course, there was a lot of, chaos in our culture. And look, there's chaos in our lives. And chaos isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's, it's the yin to the yang. But if we allow ourselves to be, thrust around by the storm, well, then you're just subjected to the storm. And there's always going to be storms in your life. So a lot of my work has been, how do I stay steadfast in the storm? How do I not be a victim to the circumstances? And you realize that you have that ability, and you absolutely do. We're all, you know, co-creators of our experience at the very, very least. And not getting swept up in the polarity, not getting swept up in, oh, this is going on over here and this is going on over here. Not allowing yourself to go, oh, I'm getting thrown around by the outside world. And just sitting in stillness, you know, connecting, breathing. Ah, jeez, people know about breathing. Breathing. Letting the tension go with the breath. Coming back to closer to your center. Aligning yourself in things like gratitude. You know, once you think of something you're grateful and try to tune to that frequency of gratitude, it has a profound effect on you. You can be in, you know, we feel like, I know I did. For years I thought I was a slave to my emotions. Like, that's it. My emotions control me.
Yep.
And now I go, no. My emotions emanate through me. I am the one creating my emotions, all of them. About 4 years ago, pretty close after I got out of rehab, I got rid of the phrase, he makes me mad, or that made me mad, or this makes me mad. Nothing makes me mad. No external force has the strength, has the power to pull my emotions. I can experience anger, but I am the one choosing that experience. Now, the question is, you might not understand how you're choosing the experience of anger, because that's because your subconscious is running the show. And until you realize that your subconscious is running the show, it's going to, I think it's a Carl Jung quote, something about, you know, people who don't realize their subconscious is directing things will be a victim to it and call it fate, something like that. So if you don't understand that your subconscious, if you don't understand, you know, no, this is just makes me mad. No, it doesn't. You're choosing to experience anger. Why? And if you don't have the answer to why, you haven't unpacked that. You haven't uncovered these subconscious beliefs that you developed over the years that have created the you that you think you are. The subconscious that has created the character that you identify with, that you're not. It's just the character that you're playing as. And until you realize that, the subconscious is going to run the show. And you are going to be a victim to yourself and think and confuse that with thinking you're a victim to the world.
As an emotional person, I agree with that, because I am like that. I do that all the time. Like, oh, that pisses me off. Like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I always, because being bipolar too, but like, I feel like sometimes I am a slave to my emotions. I'm just like, oh, that's just how it's supposed to be. Like, I just kind of let it go. But that's like pretty much what I'm trying to work out and work on myself.
Yeah, man. And look, you know, mental health is such a real thing. And I mean, it seems like it's more prevalent now than ever. It's like, what's happened?
Yeah.
What's happened in our world? Is it just like, well, we're noticing it more? It's like, yeah, maybe. Or maybe our habits are creating it, you know? I was, you know, if I look back on my life, I would say, yeah, I was depressed my whole life. There's times in my life I would spend, you know, 22 hours a day in bed. For a while. Yeah. And I got on antidepressants, and the antidepressants worked, and they, you know, they didn't work as well. And then I would do more drugs, and then I would get off drugs and back on antidepressants and back, you know, whatever. It was a little over a year ago. And I always wondered this. I just went, well, what is this depression? And this is just my story. I'm not saying this to sell anybody on anything. I'm just sharing my experience. But what is this depression? What it's like? There's no test for depression. I started to look up the chemical imbalance theory of depression. I go, yeah, I don't know if it's that at all. And is this a result of just the way I live? Are there habits I can have? Like, what is this depression? Am I reinforcing depression by saying I'm depressed? And yeah, so about a year ago, I finally was like, I'm done with this. I'm done with this storyline in my life. I'm done with this aspect of the character that I've created. Like, I'm ready to move on. And look, this is just me. I'm not suggesting this to anybody. I got off the antidepressants I was on. And I said, yeah, I'm going to do this. I am done identifying as I'm depressed. And I started to identify as sometimes I experience low energy. And changing, taking the same facts, but shifting that story allowed me to go, well, if sometimes I experience low energy, what I have to do is learn to harness all the energy that's around me. We live in infinite energy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so what habits can I have? How can I learn to get in harmony with my body to create more energy? And it's been great. You know, that was a year ago. I haven't taken a pill of anything in a year. And that was for me, for my experience to go, yeah, you are not a victim to your mind. Depression isn't a thing that's happening to you as though you felt your entire life, because that's how it feels.
Yeah.
That's how it felt to me. This is happening to me. This is happening to me and I can't do anything about it. It was, for me, an experience that goes, yeah. The depression was telling you something and you worked through the thing it was telling you. And it was coming through you. And to learn to, master yourself is to master your experience, right?
Exactly. I'm very happy for you with what you've been through and how you got to where you are now, sharing your story and giving this knowledge. Even though I think it's always good to see when someone says, it worked for me, it doesn't have to work for you. I always think that is a great indicator that someone is actually putting it together, because we can't be like, oh, this worked for me, so it's got to work for you. It's like, no, we can't. That doesn't help anybody. Mm-hmm. And
it's just to share my experience. So I shared that on a video last year on Jackson Stone's project, You Are Loved. And I had some feedback that people were saying, oh, it's dangerous. You're telling people to, you know, get off of antidepressants. And first of all, I'm not saying anybody to get anything. And, you know, and maybe it's dangerous to be on antidepressants.
Yep.
You know, I've gone down a lot of this last year, going down the health rabbit hole and medication and all of it. And there's an alternative way to view your life than the view that you're in right now. And that's the thing that I've learned the most over the years, is we are living in a story of our creation. We confuse this story for reality. And it seems real. It seems like, no, but this part is real. It's like, no, this part is a story. But it seems real because it has to seem real, because that's the reality we're in. We're in reality where you create the boundaries, and then you go up to the boundaries if you're not too scared to, you know, if you can live in fear and go, yeah, I'm not gonna push the boundaries. But this game we're in is a game where you create the boundaries of your reality, and then you walk up to the boundary, and then you go, oh wait, it's not there. We create our own limiting beliefs for our experience. And this is best I can tell, man. This is existential shit. Best I can tell that this is part of what this reality that we're in is. It's a game of growth, where you're the one that creates the obstacle course for yourself, yeah, basically. So you can get trapped in your story and go, well, no, this is just reality. And that's, you know, something that, I talked about, I mentioned in passing, you know, psychedelics. And, you know, last time I did something was probably in February or something. But every, you know, few months in my journey, again, this I'm not saying for anybody else to do, in my journey, they've been a tool to pull out of the rigid neural pathways that I've created my entire life, because that's what we do. We run the same patterns over and over and over again, run the same neural pathways over and over and over again. And you're so ingrained in that road, you think that's how things are. And, you know, one of the things that psychedelics has been a tool to just pull off those tracks, those hard-worn tracks for a little bit and go, oh, no, I don't need to have any insecurity about this. This fear is ridiculous. I'm just making this up. This is just, I am all there is, was, and ever will be rolled up into this character that I'm playing right now. I don't need to be a prisoner of, you know, because we're prisoners of our minds. We create these bars, you know, these walls up. And one of the biggest life-changing things to me was the realization all my problems are inside of me and all of the solutions are inside of me too. Realizing that I am the thing that I'm contending with, and I am the thing that is healing it. It is, the answer is in me. The answer is me. So whatever you're doing out there in your world, if you think the answer is something external, it's not. It's in you. I promise. Yeah, life's a wild goose chase until you realize the place to look.
That's very true. I do feel like a lot of people are taking to psychedelics these days to help them out. And I'm like, whatever works for you, doesn't harm you or somebody else, go for it. Microdosing, I feel like it's hot on the streets right now with most people. I feel like that's what's helping a lot of people right now.
Yeah, I mean, microdosing certainly is something that a lot of people report to be, you know, advantageous. Just like you know, it's to take a imperceptible amount, but it loosens you up a little bit. And it's not like gonna, you know, take a shot of alcohol, well, maybe, but
yeah.
But it seems to loosen the, again, we run these same patterns in our life so much. And if you can just get a little bit of wiggle room from the patterns that you're in, from the habits you have, and just change your perspective just a little bit, it will send you on a new path.
Yeah.
And so many people are so caught up in their perspective that it's a trap, and you're free to pull out of that perspective whenever you want.
Exactly. Now I'm going to finish up, Jimmy. I can't thank you enough. This has been such a great interview and just a great time with you. You're a great person. I'm happy for you from everything you've been through, and you're doing great, and I love it. But I'm going to ask a couple of my wrestling questions just for the sake of me asking wrestling questions end up. What is it like working with a wrestler you do not get along with?
I'm trying to think of any times that there are guys that I didn't get along with. I feel like I mostly got along with everybody.
Why are you that guy? I feel like you are that guy because you're friends with everybody. It's like if you type in Jimmy Jacobs in another wrestler's name, you will be in a photo with some guy.
Yeah. Well, I've been around a long time now. Look, I think maybe there were some people that didn't like me at different points, but rarely was I working with anybody that that I didn't like. Oh, yeah, there was a few times. Right, there you go. I had to like roll through the Rolodex. Oh, 2004. Yeah. There it is. I wasn't the best in 2004 anyway. I think, look, man, as long as you treat people with respect and kindness and professionalism, mostly it's reasonable. Mostly. But yeah, those are the answers, right?
Yeah, sure. Who's a guy or a girl that you would see, you would be billed with, you're going to have a match with, and you'd be like, fuck, I'm going to be sore tomorrow?
Oh, Roderick Strong.
Oh, wow. Those slaps and those
crap, man. Yeah, he's rough. Woo! Love Roddy, but he beats the crap. He used to beat the crap out of me. And there's nothing I can do. It's like, I chop him back and he'll just do it harder. I feel like he just cry in the corner. Just like, don't hurt me.
Roddy in his shitty little boots. Is there anything, like, when you're wrestling with somebody, what is, like, the funniest thing someone has said to you mid-match where you tried not to break, or vice versa? Like, you're like, dude, come on, you can't say that right now. Like, I see sometimes wrestlers will put, like, a thumb up someone's butt when they're covering them to see if they'll break. Like, shit like that cracks me up.
Boy, I remember, I mean, every once in a while you get a guy that will do something like totally silly and totally off the wall. I remember one time I was wrestling and Jason Dukes was his name. He was a guy from Milwaukee. And we were at like this bar and I forget I think he threw his robe at me, and this was like first thing in the match. I take his robe, I like wipe my butt with it or something. I throw it back at him. He smells it and then like just like faints backwards and just like, ugh. And then I pin him, and then he just doesn't kick out.
That's fucking awesome.
That's it. We're supposed to have a match, and then you know it's like you pop for it, but then you're like, all right, now how do I, you know, bring this back around? And then, you know, I think I cut a promo. We actually did have a match after that. But every once in a while, and he had been around long enough to just be silly enough to go, yeah, I'm just going to just lay down and see what happens. And those are fun.
I like that a lot. Now, mentally, sometimes, what is like the most fucked up thing a fan has said to you in either like walking out or in person or just something you're like, dude, are people okay?
There's been a few Twitter interactions where I'm like, people aren't okay. I ICP's fans were brutal.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine. They don't pull punches. Yeah.
I remember walking around the gathering of the Juggalos and people yelling at me and, you know, whatever. And just being like, it's not real, guys. Stop. I'm a character. I'm a person that ICP hired, so they like me.
Yeah.
And it's like, can't we all go to work and appreciate it for what it is? And afterwards you go, hey man, love the performance.
Yeah.
That's how I sometimes wish it was. Now, other people want to be like, nah, kayfabe, brother. Me, I don't care. We can all come out at the end and take a bow together for all I care.
Yeah. Yeah, wasn't Cole Cabana like a cop at the Gathering of the Juggalos, and he was like driving people crazy?
Yeah, man. Yeah, those are wild, wild crowds, wild audience.
And I always say this to people that always make fun of me if I like pro wrestling. I'm like, hey, do you like movies? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, do you know movies aren't real or scripted? It's like, why can't, like, you go to Chris Evans and you see him like Captain America? That was awesome.
Yeah. Look, I mean, the reality we're in probably isn't real. We're in a play right now. You know, we're in some sort of, this isn't the fundamental layer of reality, right? So we are in some sort of thing where I'm playing as this person, Chris, and you're playing as this person, Tim. It's, you know, but part of the fun of it is to get wrapped up in it and go, oh, look at this drama. Look at this. Oh, yeah. No, this is happening over here. And I've got to do this over here. So it's just like life. It's just like a movie. It's just like wrestling. It's like the fun is to get wrapped up in it and go, this is all really dramatic stuff. But, wrestling is just like life, basically. That's what I'm saying.
Wrestling's the best, all right? let's end with this. We'll do three Mount Rushmores here, and they're gonna be pretty quick, and you probably have them. Who's the absolute person you loved working with the most, like chemistry wise like you just you knew like it was gonna be 10 times out of 10 every time?
I liked working with everybody, man. I don't know. I love the Briscoes. I'll just throw guys out.
The straps are on the line, dude. I love the Briscoes. They don't get the credit they deserve.
Dude, those guys are the legends, man. The Briscoes are freaking legends.
They really are. Like Mark Briscoe is like a comedic genius.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, dude. They are some of the best performers on the frickin' planet.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. And they have years too. They have been in, I forget what year it was, man. They turned this corner. And I remember working with them in like 2013 or 14 or something. And they were walking down the aisle. We were in Toronto, and their music hit. And the way Jay's fucking walking and that look in his face, the way Mark's going around, like, these guys are freaking stars, man. They are. They should be millionaires.
They really should. They would always, in one of their promos, they would be like, and straps are on the line. And me and my buddies like always say that in passing, like, dude, straps are on the line. And they're like legit badasses. They can work a mic. They can work a crowd, work a match. Like they should be like on top of the world, and they're fucking awesome. That's great that you brought them up. That's fantastic. Now, who would be on your Mount Rushmore of wrestlers? I feel like this might be an easy one for you.
Like, of all time?
Of all time. Jimmy Jacobs, four.
My favorite, or?
Yeah, just do your favorite, because everyone could be like, oh, like, Ric Flair, blah, blah, like, what is your, like, four, like, that would make up Jimmy Jacobs? That inspired Jimmy Jacobs?
That inspired me?
Yeah, it's, oh, shit, I don't know. Just go with your four favorite.
My four favorites. Mick Foley, John Cena, boy. Those are the big two. different guys at different times.
Yeah, there's so many different. This is the hottest question in the world because you can put them in so many different categories.
Yeah, and there's, you know, like, I love Randy Savage, and there's times where it was like, you know, like Sami Zayn was my favorite character on TV for a bit, you know, Kevin Owens, I don't know. And I'm biased towards my friends too. So
I will change the question. This will be 10 times easier. Mount Rushmore of wrestlers that you've never wrestled.
John Cena, Mick Foley. After that, I don't know. Ultimate Warrior and Randy Savage.
All right, let's go with that. Now, what about managers? Because you're a pretty good manager as well. Who's your Mount Rushmore of managers?
Oh, I mean, look, you got to go with guys like, you know, Bobby Heenan, Jim Cornette. Jim Cornette was great. I'm going to put Truth Martini in there as well, and Paul Heyman.
Perfect. Sure. I like that. Now let's end with this. I asked this for everybody because we did it in fours. What are four things that you're grateful for right now?
Four things I'm grateful for.
Yeah, the Mount Rushmore of gratefulness today.
Today, the sun is out, shining its divine information on this world. That's nice. Great to be talking with you, man.
Appreciate that.
Anytime somebody wants to sit down and speak with me, especially when it's not all about wrestling. To you know, part of the ego enjoys it, but also in a deeper level, there are things that I've worked through that I hope other people can too.
Yeah,
I desire that if other people want to no longer suffer, that they learn the tools to do that and no longer play the suffering game. And that's, you start to realize that you can play whatever game you want to play. And sometimes I play the suffering game. Sometimes I play the game where I go, oh, this is happening and I don't like it. You can go, yeah, I don't need to though. Yeah. I'm creating that suffering. I'm creating this struggle. This is me that's doing this. I'm the one that's in control of my reality.
Yeah.
And I just want people to know that. And so I'm grateful to get the opportunity to just sit and whoever listens to this, and maybe it resonates with you, maybe it doesn't. Maybe you think I'm, you know, just insane, and that's fine. So grateful for that. Grateful tomorrow. I'm gonna head to find out to Michigan
Nice.
To see some people and do some shows. And I'm grateful for this new water bottle I got. It's a structured water bottle. It's got these little waves in here from my friend, Dr. Edith Mbutu Chan, who I absolutely love. And she sent me this. So shout out to Dr. E.
Shout out, Dr. E. Jimmy Jacobs, I thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me again. I'm so happy for you that you're doing great. I love you so much, and thank you again, sir.
Thank you, Tim. Blessings.
This podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. If you are feeling suicidal, please dial 911.